I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way. Go ahead.
You seem to be completely unaware of the Constitution of Australia.
I haven't seen what she said, but let me say I support what it is that she said.
So commit suicide, Tony Abbott.
Look, I'm going to shirt front Mr. Putin.
I was offended by those things. Misogyny, sexism, every day.
And quite frankly, they should shove her and Bob Brown in a chaff bag and take them as far out to sea as they can.
I and most Australians want our immigration policy radically reviewed. I believe we are in danger of being swamped by Asians.
Such a sycophant, a social climbing sycophant, if ever there was one.
You're not saying anything, Tony. I've given you the response you deserve.
But I ain't spending any time on it, because in the meantime, every 3 months, a person is torn to pieces by a crocodile in North Queensland.
They're communists because they shoot their own people, they haven't got a justice system, and they will take over this country.
So, welcome to episode 5 of the Pop and Lock Report at popandlock.net. Today I have with me Emilio Garcia Cruz of the Front and Center podcast and deputy editor of The Unshackled. Say hello, Emilio.
Hey there.
I also have Jacob Long, once again, of the Australian Traditionalist. You can find his page on Facebook. Say hello, Jacob.
Hello, good to be with you.
And I also have with me Martin Hartwig, who is a contributor and commentator for The Unshackled. Say hello, Martin.
G'day, how's it going?
So, first of all, today is the 100th anniversary of the end of World War One, remembered in Australia as Remembrance Day. So, at 11 a.m. on the 11th of November 1918, the guns on the Western Front fell silent after 4 years of continuous warfare. The Allied armies had driven the German invaders back, having inflicted heavy defeats upon them over the preceding 4 months. In November, the Germans had called for an armistice in order to secure a peace settlement, and they accepted the Allies' terms that amounted to an unconditional surrender. So we remember the 11th day of the 11th month as bringing to an end World War One. Of particular note is the use of the poppy symbol, the red poppy. This came about when, on the 9th of November 1918, inspired by the Canadian soldier John McCrae and his battlefront-themed poem In Flanders Fields, Moina Michael, an American humanitarian and professor, wrote a poem in response called We Shall Keep the Faith. I'm just going to read it. Oh, you who sleep in Flanders Fields, sleep sweet to rise anew. We caught the torch you threw, and holding high we keep the faith with all who died. We cherish too the poppy red that grows on fields where valor led. It seems to signal to the skies that blood of heroes never dies, but lends a luster to the red of flower that blooms above the dead in Flanders Fields. And now the torch and poppy red we wear in honour of our dead. Fear not that ye have died for naught. We'll teach the lesson that ye wrought in Flanders Fields. I apologize for my awful diction there. I'm not too used to reading poetry. But yeah, the poppies bloomed across some of the worst battlefields of Flanders in World War One, and naturally, due to their red color, became a symbol for all the blood spilled in the war.
Spare a minute, folks.
All right. Well, I guess we'll get into... We have a lot of U.S. new stuff to get to today, which it's good to have Emilio on for that as an American citizen.
An American leftist.
An American center leftist, yes.
Center right, more like.
Yeah. In Australian news, Daniel Andrews, the Victorian premier, has been caught out in a secret Chinese One Belt, One Road agreement without seeking federal government oversight. So Nine News wrote to the Victorian Labor government asking for a copy of the agreement harbored between Andrews' Labor government and the Chinese government. and posed other questions to try and shed light on how a state government came to sign up to what is a controversial initiative brokered between what is essentially a foreign power that wants to, that has shown aggressive stances towards ownership of Australia's land.
It shouldn't be brokered at all.
No, exactly.
If it were to be brokered, it should be federal. But
there's no, there's no popular appetite to become a part of this Chinese colonization of the ASEAN region that China is aggressively pursuing. But the Victorian government's response to Nine's questioning is, the Memorandum of Understanding is a confidential agreement between Victoria and China. As is standard with such agreements, it is not a public document. The Victorian government consulted with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade during the Memorandum of Understanding's drafting process, and the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade have been provided with a copy. The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, when asked by Nine News about this, said, "We became aware in June that Victoria was considering an MOU on the Belt and Road Initiative, but the government was not informed that the MOU was signed until it was announced on the 25th of October. We have not been provided a copy of the agreed text." So it's pretty much just plain doublespeak.
That's insane.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is.
I mean, Victoria, have we come to expect anything better of the state of Victoria at this point?
No, it's
worst possible interests of Australia.
Honestly, if Daniel Andrews' government can win another election, then I mean, Victoria is probably already a lost cause, but if Daniel Andrews can win another election after all of these scandals, after all of this, everything that Victoria has been through, everything that Melbourne particularly has been through, and we just saw another terror attack, which we'll get to in a bit, if Daniel Andrews can win another election there and his Labor government can win another election, I don't know what to think. Sad, but true.
My God, absolutely. Yeah.
I just generally think a lot more clarity would be expected of a state government and some consultation or coordination between state and federal. Obviously, that hasn't been given to the people of Victoria, though. I hope they can express their displeasure in the coming election.
Yeah, well, there. So Andrew's government's defense of itself is that keeping a document like this secret is because, well, there is no standard protocol that demands that it be released. They say the reason for the secrecy is that, quote, both parties are required to agree to release the text of the MOU, and China has not agreed to do so. So,
would have thought that China wouldn't want their shady backing deal with the state of Victoria to be seen by the federal government.
Exactly. Who would have thunk it?
They don't want to release it because it's shady as fuck, and no one wants to accept what's going on.
Yeah, anyone... Parties. So for our listeners, we don't really have time here to go into the Chinese Belt and Road or One Belt, One Road initiative, because it's a pretty complex development in geopolitics. But if you just Google it, there's a lot of information on it. You should really definitely look into it. It's from the more Chinese skeptic sides of politics, which is certainly where we line up, it is an initiative by China to dominate the world,
to displace the US as the governing party.
All right. So I'm sure more detail about that will come out in the coming weeks or months. So moving on, in other shitty state Labor governance, New South Wales Labor leader Luke Foley, who is currently in opposition, has been accused of groping an ABC reporter at a parliamentary function in 2016. The reason that it hasn't come out until now, according to the ABC, is so supposedly the victim, she immediately reported this to the ABC, but they respected her wishes in not bringing it forward and not making a formal complaint about it. Luke Foley is basically denying it, and he's actually said that he's going to pursue defamation proceedings against the ABC, which is interesting. And I mean,
it seems like he's going back on what he's initially stated.
Well, sorry, go on.
Yeah, well, from what I'd heard, he'd said, it wasn't malicious. I was drunk. I'm not normally like that. I'm just a big drunk idiot.
Yep.
His initial statement.
It's actually worse than that. That wasn't actually, I don't think that was his statement. He, well, that may have been his statement, but according to the reporter who was groped, he has actually called her and said those things to her. Like, he actually said in a phone conversation to her, look, I don't remember the night. I don't know what happened, but I'm just a drunk idiot. I hope you can forgive me. So he's all but admitted guilt.
Basically. He also resigned. Is that correct?
Yep. He stepped down as leader.
Initially, he was going to, yeah, but then he received advice from his legal team saying that he doesn't have to step down.
He stepped down as leader because he said that he can't both fight like an election and also the defamation proceedings. So he's retaining his seat as an MP, but he's just resigned the actual leadership of the state party.
Gotcha.
But
one interesting thing about the story that I found.
Yeah.
Was that she stated that she froze up during the initial attack. And there's a number of keyboard warriors, women saying, oh, I never would have let that happen. I would have bashed his head in. Heard of fight. There's fight, flight, and freeze.
Mm.
Okay, it's not just fight and flight. So, you know, believe women. I think it's a perfectly reasonable response to freeze up if the Premier of New South Wales comes and puts his hand down your pants.
Yeah, it's pretty graphic. Ashley's actual description.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you want to talk about what the actual allegation is, so Jacob? Yeah.
Ashley Raper's actual description, her recollection of the events was that, so she says, to set the record straight, in November 2016, I attended an official Christmas function in the New South Wales Parliament House for state political reporters, politicians, and their staff. This is what happened on that night. The party moved from Parliament House to Martin Place Bar after a number of hours. Later in the evening, Luke Foley approached a group of people, including me, to say goodnight. He stood next to me. He put his hand through a gap in the back of my dress and inside my underpants. He rested his hand on my buttocks. I completely froze. So he's actually moved his hand
into her underwear. Yeah, it's quite...
Yeah,
as
into
far
her
as...
most private areas. Yeah. Underneath her clothes, so it's obviously an intentional act. You don't accidentally slip your hand underneath someone's clothes. He was likely intoxicated, but that doesn't excuse him at all.
Well,
in really strong contrast to the other cases that we've been seeing with Me Too, the guy is basically admitting guilt. There's actually very good reason here to believe the woman, as opposed to the situation we've seen where it's kind of like one person's word. So, I mean, I guess there's really at this moment no reason not being truthful.
And she didn't wait to make a statement about it. Her colleagues were aware of it.
Well,
directly after.
There's a direct witness. There's another
Sean
reporter
Nichols.
Witnessed it directly and confirms
She says in her statement, this was witnessed by Sean Nichols, who was the state political editor at the Sydney Morning Herald and is now an ABC journalist. And obviously they agreed to keep the events in strict confidence with one another. But now I believe he has come out and said that he witnessed the events.
I'm shocked that he's fighting it, like that he's pursuing defamation against the ABC over given those circumstances. I expected him to just resign in disgrace, but you know.
Well, it's I don't know what his tactic is. Is he trying to save a little bit of face? I mean, he apparently already, unless I'm misunderstanding the situation, he kind of admitted to it. He got in touch and said, I'm a drunk idiot, I'm sorry.
Yeah, if they can find those...
That is defamatory.
If they can get those phone recordings, then he's sunk. Like he's done for.
To play devil's advocate here for a second, I've just looked up when the New South Wales state election's going to be held, and it says 23rd of March. So that's what, like 4 months away. So the timing of this, it's like what, 18 months after the incident, and she's quote unquote reluctantly come out. The other side of it, like yes, if he did do this, it's absolutely inexcusable. But is it possible? This is purely speculation that they've decided to keep their powder dry and leave this until a time that they can use it to damage him in the most
damaging
way.
That probably is a thing. Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, I don't see it either way. Like, I'm not trying to defend him or anything. I just think the timing's quite interesting.
No, yeah, definitely.
I think there's political considerations, but it's different from what we saw with Kavanaugh, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
It was like clearly fabricated to attack him. Here was, well, we have this, and let's just use it when it's most politically expedient to release it.
Mm.
Yeah.
And not that I'm glad that this sort of thing happens, but it is somewhat good to have the ABC and the Labour Party tearing each other apart. Like, it's... as far as I'm concerned, I hope that they tear shreds off each other.
If they can shred each other into inexistence, that would be fantastic.
It's crazy how male feminists are drunk, perverted creeps, right? Who would have thought?
Crazy how it'd be like that.
Who would have thought?
Yeah, crazy how it's like that. So this week, moving on to our next Australian thing. God, we still need to get to all this US stuff. So Malcolm Turnbull has done a solo episode of Q&A, basically diagnosing and patting himself on the back over his ousting of the Liberal Party. And so to give you a quick summary, basically, Malcolm Turnbull says he has a big brain. Everyone is very mean. The Conservatives are mean. Sky News are very mean. But he's very smart and it's all a big conspiracy. And there was nothing wrong with his leadership. So I'm just going to play a clip of him.
What you've seen increasingly is the right saying, if you don't, even if they're not in a majority, if you don't give us what we want, we'll blow the show up. And that is intimidating and bullying. And that was at the heart of the coup back in August. Now, that is a real threat to the Liberal Party.
Don't you guys feel bad for him? He got bullied.
Can you please edit in this sad violin over the top of that?
Yeah, I will.
And that is intimidating and bullying. And that was at the heart of the coup back in August.
Please press F.
It's sort of the typical behavior that you expect from a narcissist. It's the shifting of blame, the absolute refusal to accept any responsibility for their own failures. But that's, I suppose, what we've come to expect from little Malky.
Yeah, and I guess that's why we enjoyed what I believe anyway to be the best moment of that Q&A episode, when one of the audience members delivered a question saying, "Mr. Turnbull, early on, I thought you had a vision for Australia. I saw you as a potentially great leader, intelligent and economically wise. I was sadly disappointed with your time in office. You were ineffectual, not able to make the hard decisions, nor confront the media to argue your case, unengaged with the public and biding your time towards the end. I would like you to take responsibility and not to blame anyone else for this. You had the opportunity and you blew it. What do you have to say to the Australian public?" Can you guess what he said? Well, he obviously didn't take responsibility. He deflected the blame and he responded saying that his government's achievements would speak for themselves and proceeded to reel off a list of them. Strong jobs growth, tax cuts, investment in infrastructure, schools funding, and the supposedly right-wing politician who legalized gay marriage. You know, he also listed his personal successes in dealing with Donald Trump, which I would kindly refute.
Dealing with...
It's good that he did the jobs and growth thing because, you know, if he hadn't have done that, then would he really have been a Liberal Prime Minister? It's all about the jobs and growth. Did he stop the boats? Didn't hear him say anything about stopping the boats. That's what we've come to expect, right? It's the same regurgitated points.
In terms of dealing with Donald Trump, just the way he's worded that sentence, you picture that phone call that they had in which Turnbull was grilled by Trump, treated like a child.
Yeah.
But what he was really referring to, apparently, according to onenews.com article, was that he was able to protect the Australian steel industry and thousands of jobs from what would have been a 25% tariff imposed by Trump. So, yeah, I can get on board with that. But it's just funny the way he worded it because you just picture their personal interactions.
No, I wouldn't get on board with that,
actually. Would he like to be remembered as a strong man?
He doesn't deserve the credit for that.
The reason that Donald Trump is doing the steel and aluminum taxes at all was because he wanted to squeeze his adversaries he believes to be trading from a hostile position into dealing with them. So I wouldn't call that particularly on behalf of Turnbull at all.
The whole steel thing seems to be shoring up from Trump's side. It's shoring up his voter base. A lot of his seats that he won are from those wheat belt states, those coal mine states, you know, places that used to have a manufacturing base that all kind of moved offshore.
I'm just going to play So Jeff Kennett, former Liberal Premier of Victoria, he had some words for Malcolm Turnbull, so I'm just going to play them.
Malcolm Turnbull is selfish, bitter, twisted, and hypocritical. He is blaming his colleagues in August for doing what he and his colleagues did 4 years ago to Tony Abbott. If Malcolm continues like this, like a walnut, he is going to shrivel.
Like a walnut, indeed.
All right. I don't get the analogy there.
Yeah, I don't know. Some old.
I thought he was going to say something about cracking or turning to crack.
He's going to
shrivel. Yeah, that would have made more sense.
No, he's going to shrivel, guys. Yeah, I don't know.
Like a walnut.
So there was, sadly, another Melbourne terror attack late on Friday afternoon. We're not going to spend too much time today picking it apart. I think we might do a bit longer on next week's show. There is a fair amount of coverage on theunshackled.net you can check out. But yeah, I think once all of the facts are settled and we have a bit more info, police will probably have investigated into his terror links and we'll do a longer, diagnosis of it next week. But for now, we just want to give a shout out to the trolley man who it turns out is a homeless bloke in Melbourne who arguably was a little bit in the way, but his heart was in the right place in terms of trying to fend off the attacker and keep him from swinging the knife at anyone else. So there's a GoFundMe currently for him, which I'll link to in the show notes. It's currently at about $17,000 at the time of recording.
17 now?
In 12 hours.
Okay, so to put that in perspective, about 2 hours ago, it was at $7,000.
Yeah.
So it's doubled in that 2 hours.
It's just looking at the donations. It's getting like $40 to $100 per minute. People are flocking to it.
Yeah, and I mean he's homeless. You know, there's this thing with homeless people where they're like, oh, they're just going to go spend it on drugs and alcohol. They're homeless for a reason, whatever. But honestly, like, I don't care. I don't care what he spends it on. Like, they even say that in the GoFundMe. They're like, he can spend it on whatever he likes. You want to spend it on hookers and blow it all in 2 months, you live your best life, buddy. You've earned it. You know what? You're an Aussie hero. But we also shouldn't forget the officers involved.
Right.
That would have. It seems like they're very much hamstrung. They're not really equipped to deal with it. You know, you've got a guy running at you with a knife, and they've got a telescopic baton. They've got nothing to actually shove him back with. They have to keep backing away. Like, they're just not equipped to deal with it. But it's good they're at least armed, unlike UK cops. I think we were joking earlier, like, the UK cops would have been like, oh, no, we've got to call the armed police.
Yeah.
What do we do? Throw some crumpets at him, governor.
Well, it just reminds me of the commissioner who ran from the London attack. Yeah. I believe he was a commissioner.
Yeah, he was the acting commissioner. And that was in the first episode we talked about that, and he was a knight also. He was a knight. one of the Queen's best.
What a sad state of affairs.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on to this plethora of US crap we got to talk about. So, first of all, in diagnosing what's happened in the US midterms, one particular story has fallen by the wayside, which is that a dead brothel owner, Dennis Hoff, won the Nevada race for the Republicans. He's a brothel-owning Republican who died last month, and he's now been elected to the Nevada state legislature. Under Nevada law, dead people remain on the ballot, and he still attracted 68% of the vote, widely beating the Democrat candidate. Election. Yeah.
I wonder if it was actually known to the majority of the voters who voted for him that he was dead.
Like, I wonder if the people of Nevada are aware of anything that's fucking going on at any time. I've been to Nevada. It's pretty fucking crazy.
Yeah, the heat does crazy things to your brain.
No, I think they were just voting along party lines. I think that's what happened. I can't imagine that you would have 68% of the voting public electing. I just can't. I mean,
it is a pretty good protest vote, though, even if they do know. They're like, we'd rather a dead guy to a Democrat.
A dead pimp than a Democrat. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
Better a dead pimp than a Democrat. That's amazing. He had nicknamed himself the Trump from Pahrump after the town he lived in called Pahrump in Nevada.
Oh my God, this guy's too much.
I wonder what kind of a house of iniquity he ran. It's like for an extra $5, our ladies will pray with you after they've released you from your demons. I run a clean house here. Would you rather me or them? clown world.
To show how unsavory the Democrats have turned out.
County officials said they would appoint a replacement candidate from the same party for his seat. So that's good. At least there's that. What a great day for America.
Right?
Mr. Hoff is a thrice divorced author of the book The Art of the Pimp.
How is this getting more coverage?
The Democrat, yeah, I know. The Democrats ran. The Democrats in Nevada seem to have pushed for an anti-brothel and anti-prostitution initiative, at least from the grassroots level. In most of the US, you tend to see Democrats and left-wing people being pro-sex work, and it appears that they actually just took the opposite side for partisan purposes here, but it clearly didn't pay off in Nevada, which I don't know why they would have thought it would. Interestingly, it's not that Nevada is overwhelmingly Republican either. It seems like in all of the other seats that they had up, Republicans got demolished. So Mr. Muth, who is Mr. Hoff's campaign manager, made a statement and said, "I know Republicans in Nevada got massacred tonight, but my man Dennis Hoff crushed his opponent from the great beyond in AD 36, and we crushed the anti-brothel initiative in Lyon County by about 80%. So pardon me, but I'm celebrating."
No, I mean, I can't argue with that.
It's a win for everybody.
All right, so continuing in diagnosing the weird and wonderful of the US midterms, New York millennial and professional idiot Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the socialist, was elected to her seat, much to the left's excitement. But Vice News has already penned a sob story for her titled "New York Millennial Can't Afford to Move to DC Before Her Job in Congress Starts." And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she was recently called out for wearing, I think it was like a $3,000 dress or something, was it, in an interview?
Right.
It was a $3,000 outfit. Yeah. Shoes alone were like $500.
I was going to say, I remember the shoes being a big point of contention. I know a few Marxists as well who wear $500 shoes. I always think that's a bit weird.
Yeah.
They're also made of leather, so.
Yeah, it's the old stereotype of the champagne socialist.
Yeah, well, it's very true, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, their parents, generally, they come from these, I think Luke was talking about it last week. You know, their parents come and they work hard and they do dirty work, and then their children feel out of place, and then they rage against society and they find an ideology that appeals to their victim mentality, which is socialism. And then even though they might come and have a really great upbringing, what's interesting, though, I think, we were discussing it earlier. She claims that she's from a certain area of the Bronx.
Oh, yeah.
Parchester, which has a very multi-ethnic, diverse demographic, with, says here, 42% African-American, 12% Asian, and goes down from there. So she claims that she's from Parchester. When in actual fact, if you look on the Wikipedia page, under Yorktown Heights, New York, under notable residents, we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, And if you look at the demographics of this area, it is 90% white. Well, it's much like what was that state? There was that state where they were saying, oh, it's too white. You know, the crime rate's too low. How do we change the diversity rate? So she's from one of those like perfect little white picket fence communities. And she's like, oh, how do I appeal to the disenfranchised? Oh, I'll say I'm from the Bronx, but not where.
No, she's a freaking liar. I mean, no one would have voted in that place for Brown, you know, Gunderson. They had to go for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It was 100% an identity politics vote. And what strikes me more about where she actually came from versus where she actually claims she came from is the place where she actually grew up after the age of 5 is very economically well off.
Yeah.
People make a lot of money there. It happens to be 90% white because that's how most rich neighborhoods in the U.S. are. It's important to note that it's extremely safe. It's extremely well-educated. She was probably surrounded by people that had very highbrow jobs. Like, you're the most privileged little girl in the United States. Yeah. You got to work as a bartender after you graduated from college with no debt and become a congressperson.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah, that is insane. Like, the fact that you can get elected as a 27-year-old bartender with no real life experience, just a degree. To be honest, that's what's wrong with American politics. Like, really?
It says here that the median income for Yorktown Heights is $137,000 per annum.
She's super good.
That's... Yeah.
Pretty sure. Not from... Yeah. And the suburb you were talking about before, I forget what it was called, but the one where she lived where she lived until she was about 5, where she claims that she is from, you know, I'm from the Bronx. The median income there is like 50,000 or something. Like, it's like less than half of that more upscale place where she moved. So she's very happy. She's very keen to project the image of from poverty and from the true working class. But the fact is, her parents were extremely hardworking immigrants. They're actually an American success story, and they were able to, due to their hard work, move into a very, very upscale area, which is majority white and extremely safe.
And so what she took away from that is, let's get rid of this framework that allows people to have upward mobility. Mm-hmm. And instead, let's just redistribute the money to make everyone equally poor so well before. I think this kind of has to do also with the, you know, they talk about the millennial who can't afford her rent. It has to do a lot with that millennial mindset, which is you were not going to put pressure on your ideas. She probably grew up saying really stupid, baseless things, as we've come to expect from her. And her parents probably said, yes, you're so intelligent, my love. You're so, please go tell everyone that. And then what she did is she went to tell that to the American populace.
So, yeah, she said to the New York Times, I have 3 months without a salary before I'm a member of Congress. So how do I get an apartment? We're kind of just dealing with the logistics of it day by day, but I've really been just kind of squirreling away and then hoping that gets me to January. Yeah, that's probably because bartenders aren't supposed to be elected to Washington.
Why don't her parents just give her a loan? Why not stay in a caravan park if they've got one in DC? I don't know, rough it for a bit. Earn your stripes. Like, you say you're from the block, but you can't handle being like couch surfing for a couple of months. Like, it's character building, mate.
She's not going to be couch surfing. She's not. She's going to live very well until she starts getting her salary. Either her parents are going to give her money, or she'll stay at some, you know, some rich person's house in Washington. Like, she's not, she's just playing the victim again. She'll be perfectly fine.
Even look at the exposure she's gotten. Nobody, I don't know any other American elected officials that haven't even begun their terms yet. She has so much exposure in the media. It's insane. She's a household name, essentially, to anyone who pays attention to American politics, like both in America and abroad. She's known worldwide. She's recognizable, and she's only 29.
It's probably something to do with her crazy eyes, definitely. But that's her horse mouth. She's got a very distinctive look.
Yeah, well, she has a very distinctive way of being able to say very stupid things, even in situations where the interviewers are trying to make her look smart.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what she would look like if she went up, if she went on Tucker Carlson's show, if Apiro?
I would love that.
Or if she went, like, anyway, can you imagine? Can you imagine? And if, why doesn't she do those interviews?
Oh, I wonder. I probably she must know reasons.
Yeah, because she knows she's a fucking idiot, right? Like, you can't know
at least
so little.
Campaign manager knows that much, right?
Just to underscore how dumb she is, and the fact that we're not just making this up. Let me just play a clip of her talking about her ideas in relation to the American economy.
So explain, in your view, what it is about democratic socialism that appeals to millennials and young people.
Well, I think that for our generation, we kind of view the world through a very different lens. In my life, for example, I was born in 1989. And so at that point, I was growing up during the Clinton era. And then basically when I was in middle school, 9/11 happened. So when you think about young people, it's important to think about the general timeline, the world that we grew up in. I was about, you know, 17, 18 years old when the financial crisis hit. We never experienced really a time of true economic prosperity in the United States, you know. And a lot of what we have witnessed is the unprecedented concentration of wealth at the very top, tippy top of the 1%, and we've seen the consolidation of corporations start to really erode our wages, really erode access to health care. And so I think young people are very receptive to a very strong economic message of dignity for working class Americans.
That was really your rallying cry mm-hmm. in your campaign. It was always about working class Americans. You talk about the top versus the bottom, not the left versus the right.
Right.
Now, the economy is going pretty strong, right? There's roughly 4% unemployment, 3.9% unemployment. Do you think that capitalism has failed to deliver for working class Americans, or is no longer the best vehicle for working class Americans?
Well, I think the numbers that you just talked about is part of the problem, right? Because we look at these figures and we say, oh, unemployment is low, everything is fine, right? Well, unemployment is low because everyone has two jobs. Unemployment is low because people are working 60, 70, 80 hours a week and can barely feed their kids. And so I do think that right now, when we have this no-holds-barred, Wild West hyper-capitalism, what that means is profit at any cost. Capitalism has not always existed in the world, and it will not always exist in the world. When this country started, we were not a capitalist. We did not operate on a capitalist economy.
Dear God, where to begin? Where to begin? Where to begin? Where to begin?
There's a lot to unpack.
What? I don't understand. What does she mean that America was not a capitalist economy when it started? Does she know anything about America?
I suppose that you could say it was somewhat mercantile. I can't see the basis of
if
that.
If she means, like, banking, like global finance, then yeah. But does she know that's not really all of what capitalism is?
No, I don't think she knows. I think she just
thinks that capitalism is just like the stock market or something.
Here's my issue with this interview. That lady was clearly trying to make Ocasio-Cortez look smart.
Mm. Clear, right? She was helping her. Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Very friendly. Even then, she managed to make herself look like an idiot. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, she's only, what, in her late 20s, trying to unpack some very... I mean, no, I shouldn't give her a pass either, because her degree is literally in economics and international relations.
Exactly. And she doesn't know how unemployment is measured.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. God, we didn't even address that one.
That I was going to make. Yeah, she's saying 70 to 80 hours and, you know, you count as unemployed. Well, unemployed is... underemployed people count as unemployed. So,
and if everyone is working two jobs, unemployment would be, well, the if each person who's employed is taking up two jobs, then unemployment would be high.
Exactly. Yeah. She's going to have a say on the direction of the country.
If she wanted to make a good point, she would have mentioned that it doesn't matter how many hours you're working, you count as unemployed, you count as employed if you're working 5 hours or if you're working 70, 80 hours. Mm. So working 70, 80 hours, working multiple jobs to make ends meet. That is an issue. She could have talked about underemployment, but I'm no expert on the economy, so I'm just going to shut my mouth and say that I don't know.
There's also, that's what she should have done, really. She actually does do that. She got another question in that same interview about her views on the Israel-Palestine conflict. And when pressed on it, she just basically laughs. I might insert the clip, actually. I haven't had time to rip it, but I might insert it into the final podcast when I'm editing it.
What people are starting to see, at least in the occupation of Palestine, is just an increasing crisis of humanitarian condition.
Do you think you can expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd also just... I am not the expert on geopolitics on this issue. You know, for me... I'm a firm believer in finding a two-state solution in this issue.
Her degree is in economics and international relations.
It's okay to say that you don't have all the information. It's okay to say I don't know.
Yeah, but don't take strong positions on things that you're going to then say, oh, I don't know anything about these. I need to seek further clarification.
No, not only that, you're now an elected official. Everyone knows that Israel-Palestine is complicated. I don't think anyone's denying that. But if you're going to claim the country's strongest allies, it doesn't even have, and it's actually only occupying a legitimate state, then you should probably at least have the facts behind you.
It should be across the
issues, good rule of thumb. If you're going to deny sovereignty, a strong ally of the United States, maybe know what the hell you're talking about.
Yes.
Just to be clear, her claim that unemployment is low because everyone has two jobs was ranked pants on fire, a pants on fire lie by PolitiFact, a left-wing leaning political fact-checking site.
Extremely left-leaning. Did you see what they did to Ben Shapiro's video about...
They always tend to just... Yeah, I
moderate
know.
Moderate majority.
What was it? Explain it.
But Ben Shapiro did this video about the claim that there's a moderate majority of people who practice Islam through the numbers of, you know, Muslim majority countries and how many of them hold radical views. And it turns out that it's actually not a moderate majority. It's a moderate minority. Mm. And PolitiFact goes and ranks it, you know, misleading or half true, something like that. And then basically says, well, we're correct. You know, what he's doing is he's trying to mislead you into hating Muslims because he's a bad, bad man, essentially. So, yeah, it's extremely left-leaning, extremely partisan, and even they couldn't ignore.
Mm. Yeah. Well, let's move on to Trump's brilliant smackdown of CNN, CNN's White House correspondent, Jim Acosta. All right, so this happened the day, was it the day after the midterms? Or no, I think it was 2 days after. I think it was on Thursday, yeah. So here is Trump v. Jim Acosta.
One of the statements that you made in the tail end of the campaign in the midterms. That this caravan was an invasion. As you know, Mr. President,
I consider it to be an invasion.
As you know, Mr. President, the caravan was not an invasion. It's a group of migrants moving up from Central America towards the border with the U.S.
Thank you for telling me that. And
why did you characterize it as such?
Because I consider it an invasion. You and I have a difference of opinion.
But do you think that you demonized immigrants
not
in this election
I want them to come into the country, but they have to come in legally. You know, they have to come in, Jim, through a process. I want it to be a process. And I want people to come in, and we need the people. You know why we need the people, don't you? Because we have hundreds of companies moving in. We need the people.
Right. But your campaign had an ad showing migrants climbing over walls and
so on.
Well,
that's true.
They weren't
actors.
They're not going to be doing
that. They weren't actors. Well, no, it's true. Do you think they were actors? They weren't actors. They didn't come from Hollywood. Right. These were people. This was an actual, you know, it happened a few days ago. And
they're hundreds of miles away, though. They're hundreds and hundreds of miles away. That's not an invasion.
Honestly, I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN.
All right.
And if you did it well, your ratings would be much better.
If I may ask one other question. Mr. President, if I may ask one other question, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks.
That's enough.
Pardon me, ma'am. Excuse me, that's enough. Mr. President, I had one other question, if I may ask, on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that... that you may have
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation?
Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. Go ahead.
I think that's unfair.
You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way. Go ahead.
You're horrible, Jim. You're horrible.
Horrible.
I love it. I love it so much.
So much to unpack.
There's a great photo of it.
There's many great photos. Unbelievable. I mean, I don't want to get started on a roll because I don't want to start like being the only one talking. But there's so much to unpack there. There's so much, considering what Jim Acosta said, the intern that came over, the fallout from that. It just, I mean, these few seconds caused like this uproar.
There's the picture of it, which looks like a Renaissance painting. Trump on the right pointing, and he's trying to take the trying to hold onto the microphone.
Right.
But he shouldn't have accosted her. it's gonna cost her a lot of money in legal fees to sue him for assault. I made that one up myself. I'm very proud of that. But yeah, it's interesting they have these double standards with I didn't assault her.
I didn't
lay a finger on her.
Oh God! Imagine if Trump had done that. Imagine if he had yanked the microphone back off a young female intern who was trying to grab the mic off him because he was being obnoxious. Trump's like not even finished like answering the first sentence of the first question, and he just bulls him with like three other questions. He's trying to monopolize. That clip goes on for a lot longer than what I just.
He's a horrible person.
You're horrible.
Yeah.
CNN should be ashamed. But yeah, he's no.
I mean, here's the thing. First of all, Jim Acosta wasn't at questions. He was getting into an argument with Trump.
Yeah, he was making accusations with question marks on the end of him.
And you know what the thing is? You know, if he weren't such an idiot, he would actually have like, you know, do you think that, you know, a bunch of people that are going to a port of entry and will go back if they are not allowed? Do you consider that an invasion? Like, you know, he could have gone into the wording a little bit more. A lot of people, even on the right, were saying that Trump's commercial was extremely misleading. Some of the images he used aren't even from the border in the U.S. But that kind of gets that. I suppose what I'm trying to say is questions that could be asked legitimately of Trump and led up to the midterms ended by trying to make himself the center of the story. Like, let me tell you what I think and why you're wrong for disagreeing with me.
Yeah, he's breaking the first rule of journalism is you don't make yourself the story. You are not the story. You are a set piece. Jim Acosta is fucking obsessed with making himself the story. He thinks, like, it's a problem of CNN more broadly. And Trump has made them crazy. Since they've set themselves up in opposition to Trump, they think, like, Trump is the evil fascist who occupies the White House, and we are the good guys on the side of like peace and democracy, and here's how
we are the resistance.
And here's how Hillary can still win.
Yeah, she hasn't lost, folks. Give it hope. Give it time.
It's really pathological the way that they see themselves and the way that they think of themselves.
It's unbelievable. The most trusted name in Apples. But I mean, the fact of the matter is also there was an issue when people were saying that Jim Acosta, like, you know, beat the shit out of this girl.
Oh yeah, that's
which
very
of course
overblown.
He didn't. You know, I don't know, he was being
a dick. I mean, she was like,
if a right wing person
was like, he didn't like, you know, to say that he assaulted her is going a bit far, but he did. He stood there. Oh, yeah. He tried to monopolize the mic. It's her job to take the mic off him. He's not letting her do her job, which is ironic because that's what he's having a whinge about, that, oh, Trump didn't let me do my job. It's my job to ask 10 questions.
No, it's my job to prove him wrong.
Don't tase me, bro. Don't tase me. You know, if we were in, you know, Trump's fascist America, that's what would have happened. He got a fair bit of leeway, didn't he? Well, there is Secret Service could have stepped in and clocked him.
There's also that thing where pretty much all media outlets have admitted that they have better access to the White House than they did under Obama. Yes.
Obama was actually, like, he actually weaponized his powers against the press. And Obama put more whistleblowers in jail, the previous administrations combined. So they claim that Trump is somehow doing something super shady to the press when he's actually been so much better to them than Obama ever was.
Yeah, I mean, Obama probably would have hit the migrant caravan with a couple of drone strikes. You know, he's so fond of those.
But only the caravans in the Middle East.
Yeah. But we don't talk about the drone strikes.
Oh, because you're racist. Because how dare you talk that way about our first black president, you bigot? It always goes back to that. You're like, hey, I have a question about Obama's, you know, record on freedom of the press. I'm like, oh, that's because you're racist. That's because you hate Obama because he's black. It's like, well, no, he's, you know, he did everything wrongly. Like, not only was he just a bad president from a political and legislative point of view, he was also very corrupt. But no, like, because you hate black people.
So I'm going to play, so CNN, after this, as you would expect, CNN basically devoted the rest of their day's worth of coverage in licking Jim's poor pressed minority Jim Acosta's wounds. So I'm just going to play, this is just a clip I found on YouTube. It goes for 10 minutes of like a panel of, I think there's like five or six CNN analysts analyzing just how dare Trump do this and how dare he belittle CNN, how dare he tell us we're horrible people.
How dare he call us the enemy of the people? That's so, encouraging violence.
So here it is.
And I believe he's at the White House. And Jim, that must have been a surreal experience. Obviously, you were being very aggressive, as is the job of a White House correspondent. David Gregory and I are sitting here talking about our experiences, pissing off everybody in that room, pissing off President Obama, pissing off President Bush, asking questions in a way that made them mad at us. But President Trump did something that I've never seen an American president do, which is go on a personal rant against you for the questions you were attempting to ask.
Well, Jake, when they go low, we keep doing our jobs. I mean, that's the way I look at it. And, you know, I had a question to ask. And if we had played the tape a little bit before that exchange, you would have seen the question that I was asking, which was essentially about this lie that he told before the midterm elections, that this caravan of migrants moving from Central America to the U.S. border with Mexico is somehow an invasion when it's not. They're still hundreds of miles away and they pose nothing of a threat to the United States, but the president used that language, obviously, as we've talked about so many times, to galvanize his base. He just didn't like hearing that question. He didn't like being challenged on that point, and he certainly doesn't like being called out for his falsehoods. But of course, Jake, as you were just mentioning, that's our job. That's what we do over here. That's what Wolf did when he was over here as a White House correspondent as well. And we just can't be intimidated by that sort of thing. I was struck by the fact that the president, we thought, was going to come in there and do this victory lap. It sounded very much like a pity party, the way he was talking about lawmakers that wouldn't stand by him on the GOP side in various House races. He seems to be sort of unaware of the fact that his immigration rhetoric and his rhetoric on many levels was just turning off a lot of those suburban swing district voters. That's why people like Mike Kaufman in Colorado were staying away from him. And he just doesn't understand that. I think the other point that needs to be made is that during this press conference, the president time and again seemed to be attacking journalists of color. He was attacking my friend April Ryan.
What?
Play the race card. Play the race card.
There's so much shit going on. Like, so the attacking journalists of color. I don't know what to make of that.
Dude, my issue here is that the coverage of the press acting so stupidly actually led to some mistruths when it comes to the whole caravan issue. It's happened like 20,000 times. Like, it really has happened, just very little coverage. It hasn't, as far as we're concerned, it hasn't led to people actually entering illegally. They go to the port of entry and they ask for asylum. Even people that go into the country, especially as asylum seekers, they do not take that much money from the system. Asylum seekers are not entitled to as much of it. The ones that are preoccupying are the ones that are in the country illegally. But somehow through being so bombastic and just trying to get at Trump and not doing, you know, objective journalism, managed to not be able to defend the side that they're trying to defend.
They even used one of Hillary Clinton's slogans. Do you remember during the debate she used to keep saying, she kept on repeating this line, when they go low, we go high. Jim Acosta literally that clip just said, when they go low, we keep doing our jobs. Like the meme of like Clinton News Network, like they're literally using her slogans.
Yes. Well, that's actually a slogan from Michelle Obama.
Oh, really? Okay.
When they go low, we go high. That was like the speech she gave at the
Democratic
National. But no. Here's the thing. Also, like the race card is like, you know, blue eyes, white dragon or something. It's just like the powerful card.
You mean
the Yu-Gi-Oh reference there for Exodia. Those of you non-nerds?
Come on, everyone who watches this show, everyone who listens to this show knows what blue eyes, white dragon is.
Bunch of alt-right incels, that's what you guys are.
It's pop and lock, so thank you, Emilio, for putting the pop back into the lock.
You're welcome. But do you notice that the race card really is like, when they have nothing more to go on, it's, oh, and Trump hates black people.
Oh, yeah, by the way, he was mean to my black friend.
Exactly. It's like a black journalist said something, and he said something in return. He treated her exactly the same way as everyone else.
Yeah, it's like, what race are you, Jim?
Exactly. No, but it's like, isn't it, racism is treating a person differently because of their race, right? Apparently, when it comes to Trump, it's if you treat a person who's black exactly this racism.
Yeah, but you're not taking,
where's the line?
You're not taking into account the historical power differential. Remember, racism equals power plus privilege. All right, so let's not spend too much. Let's not give Jim Acosta what he wants and spend too much time talking about him.
It's true.
Let's move on to. So there were, I think there's about 30, maybe 40. Antifa protesters showed up at Tucker Carlson's actual home. They've found out where he lives. This was at night, so there was like an impromptu Antifa protest outside of his house, and they were basically bashing on his door. Apparently, he wasn't home at the time, and his wife barricaded herself in the pantry with the kids because she was so terrified of what was going to happen to her.
You're outside your home? The protests are protests of fascism and racism. You promote hate that led to an ideology that has led to thousands of people dying by the hands of the police, to trans women being murdered in the streets. Your policies promote hate, and we want you to know we know where you sleep at night.
We know where you sleep at night.
So if that's not an incitement of violence, then I don't know.
They also said no border, no wall, no USA at all.
Oh, of course.
Which is kind of crazy. I'm wondering. Yeah, these people, they call themselves anti-fascists, right? Antifa.
Well, that's the thing. This is literally what the brown shirts did in the 30s. These are literally brown shirt tactics. And what's scarier than, I mean, like you can say, oh, well, you know, it's just a bunch of crazies. But what's scary about this is the institutional and media classes' promotion and endorsement of this kind of thing. So the Vox and Emilio, I know you wrote an article on this for The Unshackled, but the Vox co-founder, basically Matthew Iglesias, he basically endorsed this. So he tweeted, "I honestly cannot empathize with Tucker Carlson's wife at all. I agree that protesting at her house was tactically unwise and shouldn't be done, but I am utterly unable to identify with her plight on any level." So he is not He doesn't feel bad. He can't identify with her. And this isn't even Tucker Carlson. This is his wife. He can't identify with her on any level. He can't identify with the fact that she had to lock herself in her own pantry, in her own home. And she has virtually nothing whatsoever to do with this. But he's upset that Antifa used the wrong tactics. He's upset that this makes the left look bad in, like, on a broad scale. He's upset that he could have revealed that that Antifa revealed what fascistic thugs and disgusting degenerates they are.
But I mean, we're using violence to advance political agendas. I mean, does anyone know what the word for that is?
Yeah.
Oh, look, we don't disagree with, you know, these tactics, but it's just bad optics that, you know, this has come out. Oh, now they've got an example of how our tactics are bad that they can use against us.
Yes. Well, have you heard of this new thing that they're using, the imbeciles on the left, on the more militant sides of the left? Have you heard of the concept of bad intentions within the wider
How they talk about bad-faith arguments?
Essentially, they're saying, for example, when Ben Shapiro or Lawrence Southern or whatever, they're trying to make, by asking them questions and making them see how their arguments are, that is actually being done with bad intentions and you shouldn't engage.
Yeah. They also refer to it as bad-faith arguments.
Bad-faith arguments, right, which is bad-faith is because it's making you not smart enough to actually respond to it intelligently. What a bunch of assholes, you know. What they said that about Lauren Southern when she was in Perth, I believe, or in Brisbane,
Adelaide, that when those she people asked, confronted her.
Yes, and she asked if they knew what the definition of race was. People said they thought that refugee was a race, to show you the intellectual depth of this imbeciles. But Antifa people were saying the next day is that they shouldn't even have engaged with that question. They should have ignored it.
Well, I'm waiting for, I mean, I may be wrong. Perhaps they have come out against this, but I'm waiting for, I think there was Jake Tapper, definitely Don Lemon. Both of them have on multiple occasions defended Antifa's increasing militance in the US by just saying things like, oh, well, they're anti-fascist. They're against the racist. They're against the bigotry. So they're justified in using their violence. It's not the same.
Yeah, no. I absolutely Antifa. Have seen that. And oh, yeah, it's in the name. You're right. That's what they said. You know, there's some things in the name of the party that led a mustachioed fellow in Germany to power. And I'm not sure if they're going to use the same argument there. Socialist is in there somewhere, but it's ridiculous. Yeah. And Don Lemon especially, I mean, right now, since we're talking about their dishonesty, you know, Don Lemon a couple of days ago, or well, not days ago, like weeks ago, said this whole thing about white people being the true threat, the true terror threat to the United States. There's, you know, what do you do about them? There's no wall for them. There's no wall for white people. There's no travel ban for them. So what do you do? Saying, you know, this broad segment of the population is actually prone to violence because of the color of their skin. And I lament the fact that there is no subjugating body and power to keep them in check. But it turns out that Donald Trump, you know, raising his voice at a black woman, well, that's a racism. That's my bit.
We have to stop demonizing people and realize the biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized right up to the right.
We need to stop demonizing people on the basis of characteristics such as race. Yes. And you white males better be listening. I'll edit that clip in. It was amazing.
I don't know. He's an imbecile. But they stand by it, you know?
Well,
they fired Megyn Kelly for...
Yeah, he's like their mainstay of their nightly programs, isn't he? Like, he's like on primetime, right?
No, it's him, Anderson Cooper, and what's this other guy's name?
Not Wolf Blitzer.
I forget. No, it's a younger guy. What's his name?
Jake Tapper.
And fights with Kellyanne Conway. No.
Cuomo?
That's it. Those are the three primetime guys.
Mm. To quote a great man, sad.
Jack, to quote a great man, Kofi. when you watch those videos of people protesting Tucker Carlson's house, do you hear the chants of these? Did you actually hear the chants? They were crying.
Oh.
Guys sound like they got their balls cut off. It's unbelievable. You hear these men, it's like they're not even men. You're saying, you know, we're three, you know, great big, you know, Adonises or anything, Adonai. But these guys, they sound literally emasculated. It's unbelievable. Like if you listen
to Buddha.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to be fair, how scared could Tucker Carlson really be of these people? But but they certainly the is, they're certainly people, powerful. They
as you can see from the who kicked the lady at the abortion clinic.
Oh,
they're
God,
unpredictable.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
They don't follow reasonable responses to threats.
Well, they are bug men, and we shouldn't be surprised that they act like bugs and swarm.
Absolutely. Yes. But imagine that there's a swarm of 40 people and they couldn't, I mean, they drink so much soy and tofu, they're clearly not very strong.
They just
40 people couldn't take down a door.
And so they have to compensate through being unreasonable.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know if I'd be scared of them. I don't know that I'd be scared of them, like, throwing a punch, but, I mean, effeminate men can certainly scratch very hard.
You know, I think his yes. wife
no, and then you have
been within her rights to actually blow them away. Really?
Yeah, I mean, I would have been exercising my Second Amendment rights and wandering out there with a gun and telling everyone to get the fuck off my property.
Hell yeah, brother.
Off my lawn.
Hoo-ah!
All right, well, we could probably leave it there unless you guys have anything else.
We're pretty much... All right.
All right, well... Thank you for listening to episode 5 of the Pop and Lock Report at popandlock.net. Be sure to check out our coverage over there and the Unshackled's coverage at theunshackled.net. You can check out Emilio's show Front and Center wherever you get your podcasts, and it's also up on the Unshackled. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Take care of each other, and we'll see you next week.